This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
It's a long movie. A couple of hours, not too much happens. What do you see in this movie?
A complete uncaring for the woman. It's as if she's an object. She belongs to the husband. Go back with your, I don't care what you're going through. It's just a total disconnect from reality.
And who are you talking about? The husband or the court?
The court.
The court.
The court. They don't see her as a human being. They don't listen to her. They don't care.
Everyone want to agree with that? Everyone agrees with that. Interesting. I think that the court is actually totally powerless. Right? They're like, what are we going to do? What's the grounds for divorce? They keep saying, what's the grounds for divorce?
Do you have to have
grounds? Aha. That's why you're here tonight.
Okay.
Yes. Tell me your name.
I feel the complete opposite, that they are all powerful and they just don't want to, because their best interest, they feel, is keeping the couple together.
Okay, he says that, right? Your husband wants shalom bayit, and so do we, so go back to your husband.
Mm-hmm. But it looks like they have all the power.
Yeah, it looks like it to me too.
Over her.
Yeah. Over her, but
they have no power.
Legally, in this room, they do. They can put it in jail. There's various things they can do. And there's places in the U.S. and Canada where they can actually really take action. If you have a will, there's a way.
So that's what we're going to look at. That's what I want to look at today, to see why it is that, in your perception, they can do more in Canada than they can here. It's actually not so simple.
Okay.
To make clear, it's not simple at all. There's reasons why the court is in a panic, and he keeps saying why. Aniza kukli ila. I need grounds for divorce. What are the grounds for divorce? So the husband's for sure a big jerk, right? But the court doesn't seem to be taking action. So the question is, why isn't the husband taking action? They say, is he seeing prostitutes? Is he mistreating her? Is he beating her up? If there were those things, they would do something. And anything short of that, they're not willing to do something.
He's beating her up. He's
emotionally abusing her. Emotionally abusing her, no question.
So
this is the situation when there is a husband who shows up in the court. So I think today to talk about the husband who is not available. Mm-hmm. Okay, the case that we just had most recently of Justice Uriel Levy, who is the Av Beit Din in Tzfat, in 9 years ago, there was a terrible car accident in Kiryat Shmona. The husband. The husband was in a coma. Okay. He was a vegetable for 7 years. And really, the poor woman was 34 when she got her get, right? So during that 7 years, her best years of childbearing are passing by. She was happily married. It wasn't. She had one child. And she sees that she's not, like, the husband. I think what happens when you have a bad car accident like this and you're in a vegetable state, you could die any time in the first year. And then if you don't die in the first year, and this is something that would have never happened 100 years ago, right? Because if you can't eat on your own, here's a man who can't respond in any way. He seems to be completely unaware of what's going on. And has no way of connecting with the world around him and no way of eating and drinking, but it can be kept alive indefinitely in the hospital. And the Beit Din visits him several times and can't figure out, aren't sure what to do about it. And they this judge, Uriel Levy, decides that he wants to use this halachic principle of zikui haget, which basically means the husband would want to give the get. If the husband were here now, he would give the get, so let us act on behalf of the husband. And he understands that this is a bold move, so he doesn't do it out of the middle of nowhere. He first sends to Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, who is one of the greatest of the Talmidei Chachamim in our world, Haredi rabbi, and he expresses his support. And then they send to Rav Avadya Yosef. They can't get a response from Rav Avadya because Rav Avadya was in his waning years. And they decide to go ahead with giving this psak din and freeing this woman after 7 years. And immediately, pandemonium breaks loose. Rav Avadya's son, Yitzchak Yosef, is the chief rabbi of Israel. It's May of 2004. And the whole Haredi world is absolutely on top of him. How could you do this? How can you free this woman under these conditions? They also, at the same time as the Haredi world is having their fit, how can you do this? There's another group of people like, finally, you're doing something about the paralysis that we're in, this poor woman. And basically, for 2 years, there's no appointments of any judges in the country because the left wants him to be, he's a great judge and was already on the line for a promotion. And basically the Haredim are like, we're not promoting him. And the left wing is, we want him promoted. And so they didn't appoint anybody until September of this year. In September of this year, they appointed 22 local judges, okay? Because there's so much backup. So you can imagine, like, what's happening is there's vacancies and they're not being filled. And so no one's getting a get. No one's getting a get because there's 22 vacancies and there's an incredible backup. The court just can't handle the mass. But everyone's on strike. If they're trying to negotiate, we want this guy. Everybody's trying to play their cards. Yuval Steinitz gives in, appoints 22 local judges, and that immediately changes the game. Right, because there's not the same pressure. It's like we don't have to do anything now. Now we can live without the Supreme Court. So just a few months ago, they also appointed judges to the Supreme Court and to the Chief Court of Israel. And basically the only condition, the number one condition was, and not this person, not Judge Levy. And he didn't get appointed, but he got a sort of horizontal promotion. He moved to Yerushalayim. He's living on Shalom Yehuda in our neighborhood. But he's basically, you can see what happened. It's like, wow, if you want to make a move, he put his whole life on the line for this woman. And some people are celebrating and some people are not celebrating. So sort of like try to figure out what the heck is going on here. And I picked this case, first of all, because it's absolutely fascinating to understand it. I got my smicha from Rav Herzl Hefter. He's my primary teacher. He's the head of the Har El Beit Midrash. The agreed to be the broad shoulders, Rav Daniel Sperber. Rav Daniel Sperber wanted, we learned kashrut first, okay? That's like your sort of standard, you want to be a rabbi, learn kashrut. Okay, so we took tests on kashrut. Rav Sperber wanted us to get some expertise in personal status laws because he felt like that's the cutting edge, that's the needs of the hour. And so I sort of kicking and screaming spent the previous year learning Hilchot Ishut, the laws of marriage and divorce. And I want to say that kicking, I wasn't wrong to kick and scream, because I like to learn things that I that where you can feel that Judaism is beautiful, and the laws are so very difficult. And I never wanted to go to classes on the Agunah issue. It's so very, like, I feel like the natural inclination of many people, not just myself, has been there, done that, heard that. And I sort of feel like the time has come to think of new ways to act on this issue, because I heard recently centrist rabbi talking about saving a non-Jew on Shabbat. Okay, the letter of the law, the last two classes will be devoted to or things around this issue. The letter of the law is that you're not supposed to save to break Shabbat in order to save the life of a non-Jew. That law is not, that's the letter of the law, and then the rabbis had to find ways to go around it. I heard the centrist rabbis say, citing Rabbi Lamb, but he was much to the right of Rabbi Lamb, this rabbi, saying, the law is out of date, and that's how the world, sometimes the halakha, sometimes the laws change, and we have to adjust the laws. We have to adjust the laws to meet the times of the hour. And he said it about that issue. I think he said it about that issue because it is just so embarrassing and shameful and immoral. Not just, like, no one's going to keep that law because everyone understands, every Ben Adam understands that life is life and you have to do whatever you have to do in order to save someone's life. But the rabbis, that's clear to the rabbis, and they understand that they have to fix that law. And I think that there's actually no difference between that and this. The only difference between that and this is that women are agreeing to get married under these circumstances. And if women would not agree to get married under these laws, the rabbis would have to fix the law. The shame should be just the same. And in that sense, I feel like maybe having been forced to learn these laws, very painful, and I really do want to teach Torah all the time that I love and that is beautiful. I think that we can find beautiful things in those laws. So I decided to pick this because I think it's a little bit, it's different and interesting instead of just teaching Agunah. But I'm say right up front that I think that my goal of the class is to understand why do you see these 20 minutes of this movie of 20 minutes out of 120 minutes, which is part of a 15-year torture that this woman is suffering, and we have to understand halachically what's going on here. That's what I want to try to understand tonight, and then to try to understand how can we. I'm happily married for 23 years. I asked my husband if he would consider giving me a divorce, to rework this situation. I'm afraid I have to think about whether I want to post this. I find some of the laws to be very, very difficult. And when I told him about the possibility of this case, right, that's where he said, oh my gosh, I wouldn't want that for you, right? Like, and he is willing to give me a divorce. And I mean, we're going to stay married and we're going to, you know, like figure something else out. But this case, it's a real halachic situation, and we have to sort of figure out what can we do what are the options we have to protect ourselves as women, and of course men, to protect your daughters, a daughter, and the two daughters. So to sort of think about that. So I want to just give you the basics. Here when we were learning it. Oh, I think I brought in a piece of paper, maybe not. One of my classmates is an artist also, and he did this picture, which I printed out big, but I don't want to look for it now, where he took every law, there's one sentence in the Torah about divorce, and every time the Rambam learned a law, he made the word a little bit bigger, so you can see that he was able to
certain words you can turn bigger than other words because certain words are very heavily laden with meaning and available for careful reading and deriving laws. So what I'd like you to do right now, I'll send you to Chavruta for 10 minutes to start two things. Okay, I want to understand first just to read that verse very carefully and to try to derive as many laws as you can from that's verse, the source number two, to derive as many laws as you can from source number two, which is the statement in the Torah about divorce, two verses, and then to continue on and to try to understand where is the power, okay, the power of the husband and the power of the court, because I want to get exactly to, remind me of your name again?
Lauren.
What Lauren said, well, why isn't the court doing anything? Who's the bad guy here? Okay, where is the wicked? Who? We understand that the husband's bad, but what about the court? Okay, and I want to try to show, actually, that the court is more powerless than it is wicked. Okay, and
they treat you with compassion. It's one thing to treat her like she doesn't exist. It's another thing to say, wow, I feel for you, and I'm really sorry, and I wish I could help you, but I can't. Maybe that's the difference between being an angel and Israeli. I don't know.
No, but, yes, okay, I hear you.
You know, it's also...
But they don't want to admit. This is where we're going to get into the way, the power of the state and the power of the state interacts with the power of the court and the law as it seems to be laid out in the table. So I feel like I should before introduce why is the court so conservative? The court is worried about law number one in Devarim about Mamzerim. Okay, if the divorce, and probably most of you already understand this, I'll just state it explicitly. If you get a divorce that's not a good divorce, then you're really still married. And if a woman is still married and she has sex with another man, then that's called adultery. Anything that any child, okay, adultery, that's her. And that's between her and the man. I'm not saying that the court is going to be very worried about that, for sure. Very worried about that, because they don't want to lend their hand to that. And then there's an additional thing, which is the question of the status of the child. The child will the child that comes out of that union will be a mamzer, and therefore be unable to marry Jews forever. Okay, it says till 10 generations, it means really forever. So that's what the rabbis are, that's what they're in a panic about. The fear of lending their hand to these two things. One, adultery. Two, mamzerut. Okay, that the woman, that the children that will emerge from the union that follows will not be kosher. Okay, so your mission is to now try to derive as many laws as you possibly can from Deuteronomy 24 with the person sitting next to you, and then to move on and try to figure out where is the power exactly? Where is the power? Yes, ma'am. Okay, let me bring you back together. So, who's the actor in these verses?
The man.
Okay, what's the man is the guy who's active. What's the... why is he allowed to divorce her?
He
does not find favor. Okay, he has to want to. So it does whatever he does. Okay, so this is a machloket in the disagreement in the sources, trying to figure out exactly under what circumstances. But the halacha is anytime he wants to. So you can learn both that he can divorce her whenever he wants to, and also that he has to want to. It has to come from a place of his wanting. How does he divorce her? A written document placed in her hand.
And a physically sending her out of his house.
Okay, so we need a written document. We need it to be, he needs to give it. He needs to place it in her hand. He needs to send her out. She needs to, it needs to be placed in her hand. Mm-hmm. Okay, so because this can work in the other direction too. We'll see. It can go, obviously the problem is much more acute for women. You can't compare.
But the problems can go the other way too, and I've worked with people who are having problems in the other direction. It can go both ways. But you can't compare. You just can't. Where is the Beit Din in this verse? There is no Beit Din in this verse. The Beit Din doesn't appear in this verse once, and I think that is actually where the key is to sort of understand that the Beit Din doesn't appear in these verses. The Beit Din, you don't need a Beit Din to get divorced, and the Beit Din has no ability to create divorce. In order to divorce, he has to write again, he has to give again, he has to send her away, and he has to want to. There is no Beit Din in this court. In this case. So that you see in sources 1 and 2, right? That source 3 is about the husband has to want. Source 4 is about where the Beit Din comes in, okay? Because we have a situation where the husband has to want. And yet, in source 4, we've raised this question of coercion. Under what circumstances can we coerce the husband in source 4? Okay, so under what circumstances can we coerce the husband? According to this Mishnah, Sean?
He stinks.
Okay, the husband stinks. Basically, there's two possibilities. You either have a mum, some sort of physical problem, leprosy or polypus. Those are things that get in the way of sex. Then there's this other problem that you smell. The man smells. Otherwise, the Mishnah actually doesn't mention any other possibilities.
Just a question for chronology, since the Mishnah is clearly long before the Rambam. So not having all of Rambam in front of me.
Yeah, sorry.
Does he deal with the compulsion of the courts? Because he's saying that it has to be Birtono, but in the Mishnah it's already stating that we have the authority in some instances to compel.
Right. Okay. So in source number 5, we'll immediately look at the Rambam on that. Okay, but wait. But before we get to that, let's just try to understand. So it doesn't make. It has to be Birtono, and yet there are these few circumstances that are being laid out in which he does have to. Where it seems like the Beit Din can coerce. So we have to, like, right away it seems like there's a conflict between those two things, and we have to work out that conflict. The Rambam tries to work out that conflict by saying, we beat him until he says, I want to. Okay, when the top said, the source 5, the laws of divorce. What? Right, correct. So last year in Lakewood, is there someone serving a prison sentence now? Okay, because there's a few rabbis, you can hire them to beat up your husband. They use cattle prod, electric cattle prod.
Wow.
And they had a sting operation where they actually recorded these rabbis saying, giving instructions about how to beat him up and what to happen, what should they do if the guy has a heart attack or something, because you're beating them to near death. So then what happens if he has something catastrophic? And they, in the recording, they say just dump him in the street, basically. So again, these are the reasons why I'm saying we've got to do something about this, because this is not, we don't want this to be Judaism. Okay, but that's what the Rambam suggests. I'm reading a little inside. When a man whom the law requires to be compelled to divorce his wife does not desire to divorce his wife, the court should have him beaten until he gets some desire, until he says he wants to. and the Rambam tries to figure out, since it has to come from free will, how can you combine free will with coercion? And he says, because, let's see if I can, highlight it. the So he goes on to say that if so, these are the circumstances, and it comes down this way in the halacha. If the rabbis beat you to get to accept a get, and you sit to give a get, and they do so correctly, and you say I want to, then the get is legitimate. Why is the get legitimate? Why is the get not void? Because really, I'm skipping down in the third paragraph. Why is the get not void? Down to where it says, e.g., a person who was beaten until he consented to give a sale or to give a present. If, however, a person's evil inclination presses him to negate a mitzvah or to commit a transgression, and he was beaten until he performed the action and he was obligated to perform, or he disassociated from the forbidden action, he is not considered to have been forced against his will. On the contrary, it is he himself who is forcing himself to refuse because of his evil mind. Okay, you're not, it's not you that doesn't want to give a get. It's this evil Yetzer Hara that has you're like inhabited like by a demon. And when we beat you, the demon lets you go. And now you can express your true will. Your true will is to give the get. That's the Rambam's way of trying to resolve this gap. Because he still holds, ultimately, okay? Because he still holds, like the verses, all of the power is in the husband. The Beit Din really doesn't have any ability to force you. The Beit Din can help you see what your true self really wants. But you have to really want it. And if you don't really want it, then the get is not valid. And for this reason, it has to be, the halakha has to truly want. It has to really be the right thing, okay? That is to say that this comes out in the Rambam and in Halakha, in source number 6 in the Shulchan Aruch, where he lines it all up for you. If you are compelled to give if the husband is compelled to give the divorce in a case where it's legally required, then it's your Yetzer HaTov that's manifesting itself in your Yetzer HaRa, which is being expelled. But if you're not really required and you're being forced to give a get when you aren't really legally required to do so. So the get isn't kosher. The get is what's called a get me'usa, forced get, which is not legal because the get has to come from a place of desire. The husband has to desire to give the get. And it's not his Yetzer HaTov which is overcoming his Yetzer Hara, because he had the right to refuse the get in the first place. So the Beit Din has to be acting within the Beit Din's legal limits in order to force the get effectively. Does that make sense, Dana?
How does this not defend the people, though, who are like, oh, let's just beat up this guy who's breaking Shabbat because what he needs to do halachically, and it's a mitzvah to keep it, and how could you break it? How does this not defend?
Yeah. Oh, the question of whether you can coerce people to do mitzvahs in general is a big question too, but I think I took enough for this one issue. I think that it's possible that I can also defend people to beat you up until you keep Shabbos. But we don't do that.
Right. So
because it doesn't, because if you don't keep Shabbos, that's your problem. But we have to do something about you not divorcing your wife. I'm sorry. Right? Yeah, okay, because that now you're impinging on someone else's rights. And here we're in a state. This is obvious, but I'll say it anyway, specifically for my students who aren't Israeli. You can't get married any other way in this country. Okay? There's no such thing as saying, I'm going to go get married by a reform rabbi and I don't want this. You can't get divorced any other way. Jews can only marry Jews, and they can only marry Jews through the rabbinate. There's no other choices. So this is state law. So the state has to do something about this, right? Because the state can't allow you essentially to I'm like going here to my movie, to deny the human rights of a woman who is unable to get divorced. Okay, so what we've established, just to line it up, if the husband is being forced legally by the Beit Din, it's kosher. If the court has overstepped its bounds, the get is what's called a get pasul. If the non-Jew forces you to get to give the get, it's not kosher at all. It doesn't count as anything. Okay, there's Dora right, and Dora Banan. I'm just going to mush it all together. If you so the it's not kosher at all. So for this reason, we have this situation. Why the court kept saying, "Aniza kukla ila," I've got to have a justification. Okay, and what are the legal justifications here? What? He smells bad. What if he beats her? It doesn't say it in the Mishnah. Right. Okay, so when the Mishnah gives, you could interpret it lots of different ways, right? You say, let's hear it. Someone, if you just had this Mishnah in front of you, I say, you can force a divorce for bad smell. Can you force a divorce for beating?
It should be anything that, so bad smell makes him like magil to her, right? Like he's disgusting. So anything that would make him disgusting, one could, I mean, there's certainly been stretches. So why not anything that she finds unfavorable about him?
Okay, so this is where we get into trouble.
This is all physical stuff. This is all about sex.
So you could...
It's all about babies.
You could easily expand it. You could easily interpret this broadly, and some of the Rishonim do interpret it more broadly and add things like beating your wife, or visiting prostitutes, or not providing her with her legal rights are good reasons to force. But every time the Shulchan Aruch systematically, basically, when it comes to make a conservative opinion, to be nervous about forcing, why? Because they're afraid that if they go beyond their legal limits, they'll have forced a divorce, but they will have forced a divorce that's not really legitimate. And they're terrified of forcing a divorce, right? They give you a piece of paper that says you're divorced, but you're not really divorced. And you think you've done the right thing, but you are not doing the right thing. And that is what's hovering over the rabbis all the time.
You know, we're creating so many more people who they couldn't get divorced under a banut, and it's okay, so I met the man of my dreams, and they go and they get married, and they still have a mamzer.
Yafeh. Okay, so that's why the time has come that we have to do something about this problem, right? Because exactly, but people are careful. It doesn't always happen that way because people are very nervous about their children, right? It's like you would say, I don't want to talk about this. You might say for yourself, I don't care. I'm not willing to submit myself. But to put that, I see what it does, you know, on every level, both to people who are getting divorced and people who want to convert. I wouldn't submit myself to the Rabbanut, but I'm going to because I'm worried about my children. And that concern about your children is very real. It's a very real stigma. Yes, ma'am.
This is Mary. Still called the Yoshim. It starts chapter 220. What comes before that? Is there any sense here, before jumping to beating him up, of social pressure, ostracization, no counting in the minion? What, like, is the community involved in this?
Yes, ma'am.
Can she say, sorry, I'll let go ahead and make up?
Okay, so look, I was very ambitious about what I thought I would accomplish, and I mean, I knew from the beginning that I wasn't being reasonable. Yes, at some level, okay, I'll say, there's a question about fines, for instance. Can I fine you? And this is why they're putting someone in jail, right? We see, why doesn't he just put him in jail? And this is why the Canadian Beit Din can actually, the Canadian courts, if they act too strongly, can end up forcing a get that's no good.
Oh,
other people won't accept it, right? Because as soon as this poor woman got her get, the woman from Kiryat Shmona, and her husband sitting there, her ex-husband's in a comatose, is a vegetable, a bunch of people sent her a letter and said, you ought to know you're not really divorced and we're not going to let anybody marry your children. So there's a discussion about fines and being put in prison. What kind? How much force is considered force?
But that's exactly why I asked the question about the social stuff, because no Shabbos, no minion, no...
I think those things...
It's a very different place than sitting off in jail, right, and still getting your kosher food and having minion.
Okay, so that's one way to go.
So we can do that. We can do that. All right, let me say something about this, I'm not sure. So what I was going to do now is talk about the Levi case specifically. What happened? Yeah, let me show you at least the problem. Okay, what about this poor woman? What happened with this poor woman? Mishnah, source number 6, which is really at the top of page 4. If a hearing man marries a hearing woman and she becomes deaf, if he desires, he can divorce her. If he desires, he can maintain her. Okay, in the rabbinic law, they understood cherish shote v'katan, people that don't have mental capacity. Okay, so their deaf person was a person who was deaf and dumb and didn't have, and they, from their perspective, didn't have mental capacity. How that applies today is a little bit complex, but we'll just accept what he said. If a hearing man marries a hearing woman and she loses her hearing, he can still divorce her. But he can keep her. But if she loses her mind, he may not divorce her. This isn't the part that interests me so much. If he becomes deaf or loses his mind, right? He loses his mental capacity. He may never divorce her. You understand why that is? Why may he never divorce her?
It can't be voluntary.
He can't want. He has to natan biyada. He has to shelcha. So he can't do those things. So he may never divorce her. Yes. That's where you get into the situations because the court was.
You say the Pope. It's a life term. Your life is negotiable.
Exactly, but that's what happened, and that's why you've got these guys in Lakewood who said just, and really, they're saying, look. We're going to dump him on the street if he dies. The job's done. The problem is solved. And you can see that the Beit Din also, now Rev Levi is also a good guy, but he thought, let's just wait a few years and see if the guy dies. And then we won't have to have any of this trouble. Let's just let the guy die.
It's a little bit off, but there was no, if he's a vegetable, is there any compulsion to keep feeding him? Does the wife say, we can stop feeding
you. Well, I think then they get into another set of laws, which is called murder. Yeah.
It's not murder.
If you're brain dead, then if you can prove that he's brain dead. Okay, so it gets, right, it's not necessarily not murder. Yeah, that's where we go. So look at source 7. Here's a person who is seized with cardiacos. Mira probably knows, but it means he gets some sort of mental disease, okay? And here the assumption is that they actually know how to solve it, but you can abstract from it to other signs, right? If he says, but he's mentally incapacitated at the moment that he's got this disease. If he says write a bill of divorce for his wife, his words are not to be effective, right? It doesn't mean anything because he doesn't have mental capacity. But if he said before he got ill, write a bill of divorce for my wife, and then before the divorce got given, okay, before he said give this divorce to my wife, and he appointed someone to give the get. But then he says, and then he goes mentally ill, and this is really important for us. Then he goes mentally ill. The whole time he's got this disease, you can't write the get. His last words are not effective. Okay. So if you've lost your mental capacity, even if you wrote a get before, you can't. You cannot give the get. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, two questions about that. I'll try to keep it short.
Yes.
Can you convince me that when it says his last words are not affected, it just doesn't refer to the last words,
yes,
do not write it? That's certainly how I read
it. Still give it.
Right.
You still give it, and then he
it's only the words
no,
that he's not able to.
When seized with the cardiacos, he said, do not write it. Meaning, while he's... Okay, so there's a machlok. Yes, good. Okay, so this is the machlok in the Gemara between Reish Lakish and Rebbe. What's going on here? Yes, thank you. You're right. The question, the machloket is, and we take the is are his can you give it or you do not write it while he's sick and you can give it as soon as he gets better, So you're right. That's the way, how they understand it. But we pask in the strict way that you can't give what they mean by that is when he gets better, you don't have to ask him again if he still wants to give the get. Okay, while he's sick, you can't give the get. As soon as he gets better, you don't have to ask him again, did you still want to give the get? Okay, and the question and the reason for that. So this is important to me because, from a halachic perspective, because otherwise we could probably solve the problem. How could we solve the problem? We would just have people. Yoni could write me a get right now, and deposit it with somebody. And if there's ever a need, it can be given. But it won't be kosher. They could use that if they think you're dead.
Okay.
And then you have that either you're dead or you gave the get. Mm-hmm. But if you're mentally incapacitated, then it's a whole different story.
Then how come you can not? It doesn't only suspend all judgment until after the illness passes. He's ill. He is struck with not.
Oh, you're right. Right. I know. I needed to bring the
you're
Gemara to go with this.
He has a stroke and he can't speak for now, which that could pass. That could not. But while he's
right, the Gemara. So right. I'm reading it in light of the Gemara. I should have brought you the Gemara, but it's still long. My short sheet. Yes.
We seem to have. Sources in Deuteronomy that says if you want to get, you got to write it yourself and hand it to your wife yourself. And suddenly we're talking about an agent or having someone else write it for you.
Okay, and that's perfect. Because thank you for that transition. Because that's where that's the situation that we have here with Judge Levy. Because he actually appointed himself an agent did it on behalf of the husband, saying the husband surely wants this. How could he do such a thing? He used Source 9. Source 9 introduces this principle that Zachin la'adam shelo b'fanav, ve'en chavin la'adam shelo b'fanav. One may act for, this is the underlined line, one may act for a person in his absence to his advantage. But you cannot act for a person in his absence. So if you have here we're talking about a minor, okay? Can you convert him while he's a minor? How can you convert someone when he's a minor? She doesn't have mental capacity. A child can't make a decision for herself, and so you would never be able to have a katan become Jewish. But we do allow it. Why do we allow it? Because we say surely they will want it, and we're doing it for their benefit. Okay. Similarly, if someone says, take this package for Mira, so I can accept it for Mira because I know she wants it. If I think it's something that she might not want, I can't accept it for her, okay? Because I can presume that she appointed me as a shaliach. So now the question is, what about divorce? Okay, and the reason why we never allow, and why the reason why there's this hesitancy, which you can see in source number 7 about having and you can see how the Shulchan Aruch interpreted it in the way I interpreted it in source 8. The reason why they don't allow the shaliach for the mentally ill person is because we can't, even though he appointed the shaliach before, he can always change his mind until the get is given. And it's something that people would do. If you watch this movie, you can see it's something they do. And so I don't really know what's in the best interest. I can't make the shaliach can't make decisions. He can follow directions, but he can't make independent decisions. Unless he knows that they're for your benefit. If they're to your detriment, then he can't make them. And this is true of both men and women. The idea of zikui get came up first with women. Because women also, it has to be natan biyada. Okay? And they allowed it in certain cases, either extreme cases of disability, or in cases where the woman became a mumeret, she switched to another, she changed her religion, wasn't willing to accept the get, and had already, and was had remarried living with another man as a Christian.
This sounds like they'll redo anything with guy, so he could have.
No, but here they for the guy we can solve the problem. Because we could just give him what's called a Hetzer Meir Rabbanim. We can give him a note from 100 rabbis, and then he can take a second wife, and everything will be fine.
Why can't we do that?
Because the Torah says, because according to the Torah, you could have multiple husbands. You could have multiple wives, I'm sorry. But you can only have one husband. Women can only have one husband. Adultery means to have sex with a married woman. Okay, so when a man, single or married, has sex with a married woman, he's committed a capital offense. But if you have sex with a married man, you haven't committed any offense. Okay, it's not allowed. That's Rabbeinu Gershom. Okay, but I didn't try to stick that into this class too, because that would be too ambitious. So the decision of the Tzfat Rabbinical Court is based on the Chazon Ish. In source number 10, where he tries to show that in this case, it's pure schut, it's pure benefit for the husband. It all has to be, I have to prove that the husband wants to give the get. And it's always difficult to prove that the husband would want to give the get. But in this case, I can prove that the husband wants to give the get because he is... And it's interesting how he proves it. He's not providing any of the needs for the wife. And probably he loves the wife, and he doesn't get any benefit from the wife at all. Mm-hmm. And he is getting spiritual deficit because he's not providing her needs. Mm-hmm. And so he'd be better off releasing her. And so he releases, so based on this, and the Chazon Ish said it. But even though the Chazon Ish said it, and Rav Uriel Levi was just churning up something that had already been said both by the Chazon Ish and by Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, was that it was so controversial that it held up his job for multiple years. Okay, and he didn't get the, I mean, we'll see what will happen when he'll get to the Supreme Court. So the question is, what are we going to do? Okay, because we're not Judge Levy. I'm never going to be Judge Levy. And you guys are even more so. But how are we going to, what can we do? So these are three solutions that deal with the problems, not just this one, but we can see how each of these solutions might have impacted. Okay, I'm actually recommending them all, even though we're going to see. The first one is the prenup. Okay, mm-hmm. The prenup here that I've given you the link to is the prenup of the Heskem Lichvod Hadadi by Rachel Levmore. It's on the Young Israel site. It's very, the Zohar one is almost identical. Really, there's some differences, but the halachic components are basically work the same way. The way it works is that we promise each of us to give each other a get if we want to show up in court and give each other a get. As soon as one party files for divorce, opens up a teek, the other party has up to 6 months to ask for marriage counseling, which can take up to 6 months, and or to give the get. Okay, and whoever hasn't given the get, then becomes obligated. Both parties to support the husband is obligated, and the wife is also obligated. Whoever hasn't given the get and was asked for the get. Has to start paying, and it's a reasonable amount of money, either half of my paycheck or $3,000 a month, I think it is, it says here. It's not a huge amount of money. $1,500 shekels a month.
It's
$1,500 a month. It says the shekel equivalent of $1,500 or half of my paycheck. Okay, it's 8,000 shekels. It's so this It's designed not to be too much. Why? Because if it's a lot, then it comes off like a fine. And it says in the Shulchan Aruch, I'm not so sure that I can get that a fine might be considered coercion, and it will, and then people can call your get into question. So here it's designed to be not a fine, but spousal support. Okay, it's just spousal support, which anyway we're committed to support one another. And it's designed to be an amount of money that is spousal support on the one hand. On the other hand, hurts enough that you will be motivated, that both parties will be motivated to give the get. Okay, this, they say it helps in 100% of the cases. Okay, that is to say that they don't have any cases yet where the person came to court with the hiskim signed, and neither in America, because the OU has a similar agreement, and this one is the Young Israel agreement, and they have this here. Not enough people have signed it. About 1% of the people getting married are signing it, and the Rabbanit Sohar, which is the liberal rabbis, have recently come out with it, but they're also not requiring it, so we'll see how it will come out to be until we get a mass of people signing this. This could help very greatly. When they come to court, the lawyer says to him, you better give that get, because otherwise this is going to be ugly. Okay? But they haven't actually had a situation yet, as far as I understand, where the judge has had to say, you have to pay, and as a result the get came. Everything got, all the problems got solved before it got to Beit Din. Because this was hanging over the head, and the lawyer said, what's wrong with you? You better give the get. You promised. Why'd you sign? Okay, so it nipped the problem in the bud. So far, so good on this. I signed an agreement very similar to this 23 years ago. Did you sign an agreement like this at some point? So, look, you can sign this as a postnuptial agreement. Okay, so you should get your I was thinking about doing it in Yodija maybe, but I don't know how many people haven't signed. I think that there is a need to have more. It's very in vogue in America right now, mm-hmm. to have these post-nuptial parties. They're like little weddings that you show, and everyone comes, and they sign this agreement, and it's like a way of saying, I love you, and I'm not going to hold you captive. Okay, how's this going to work for the poor woman in... It's in Kiryat Shmona, yeah, the Sfat Beit Din. It's not going to help at all. It's not going to help at all. It's not going to do anything for her. I'm not saying you shouldn't sign this. Of course, when you get married, if you get married, you should sign this. This could help you very much. But that's not going to solve this problem. Okay, here's another one by Susan Weiss. Here's her book. Marriage and Divorce in the Jewish State, Israel's Civil War. Okay, I think if you speak in that language and we start to think about this in strong terms, we might be motivated to act more strongly. Her tone is not my tone, but the stories are, it's heartbreaking. I mean,
there are a lot of couples that are simply living together and not getting married.
Okay, so we'll get to that third. Okay, third solution. So the second solution is to get married, but to what's called Kiddushin Al-Tznai, okay, a conditional marriage. And when we get married, there's a few components. One is basically this Heskim, the similar components of the Heskim that we just saw of Rachel Levmore in Source 11. And then in addition to that Heskim, we also add what Miriam suggested earlier, that the marriage can be annulled retroactively if... And then you can put all sorts of conditions. And the question of what the conditions are is up for negotiation. Some of them have in them the, if we have sex outside the marriage. Okay, that's very radical, because it doesn't leave out the possibility of adultery. But I've seen heskimim that have that. If we... but certainly if one of us refuses to give a divorce, if one of us is going to be forced to, if the wife would be forced to have levirate marriage, if the, if the husband's incapacitated in some way, then the marriage is retroactively annulled. Okay. And that it's as if we never got married. And in addition to that, okay, just to, because some people think this doesn't work, said that many halachic authorities think, because it says in the Gemara, okay, that the assumption is if you get married on a conditional marriage, that's when you have kiddushin. But once you consummate the marriage and you have nisuin, people don't want to be conditionally married. They want to be fully married, and therefore they forgo all the conditions that they set earlier, and they say, forget about those conditions. Okay, that's suggested in the Gemara. It's not clear what that means, because if the husband said you're only, that I understand when the husband says you'll only be married to me if you lose 30 pounds, right? Or if you are a millionaire, or if your father agrees, and then you consummate the marriage. And once you're married, the husband says, oh, forget it, I love you, and I'm willing to be married under any condition. So the husband has to forgo the t'nai. But the woman, why would the woman give up her t'nai? The t'nai is for her future protection, so she maybe wouldn't give up the t'nai. Okay, that really, Eliezer Berkowitz wrote the book suggesting that this is still kosher, but it's very halachically controversial. So they add a third component to this agreement, which is the authorization to act as an agent for divorce. That is to say, the husband writes the divorce, theoretically here, writes the divorce, and the divorce is deposited with the Beit Din. It won't really be a kosher divorce, because we know that for the divorce to be kosher, it has to be wanted at the moment it's given, right? We've already spent all of it. It's said how important that is. But sometimes the combination of all of these factors allow the rabbis to say, okay, once you could put all of these three things together, then the marriage really is annulled. This is halachically edgy, very edgy. But you can see that this would solve the problem for the woman from Kiryat Shmona, okay, if the rabbis would accept it. It's just very halachically edgy. But this is a way that preserves kiddushin, all of the traditional marriage, and puts enough conditions in it that the woman is fully protected. Okay, so I think that this is becoming more popular, but it's very halachically edgy. I don't know how much this has been tested in Beit Din. I think it will be very challenging to get a get in the Israel Beit Din here. Okay. Yes.
This is a naive question, and maybe the answer is beyond the scope of right now. But if you're married to someone who does not want to stay married to you, and you're no longer living together, and there's a prolonged lawsuit, and the rabbinical thugs are coming to beat you up, exactly the motivation to not grant
to get power. I think there's more than 100 men sitting in jail.
I think so too, but I don't understand why.
Because
they're
power. They're assholes, basically.
Yeah. A lot of the people...
I know a few people go through terrible, messy divorces
Divorce can bring out the worst in good people, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of the people are having a hard time to begin with. Could be mentally unstable in different ways, or just difficult people. And sometimes divorce brings out the worst in you. Okay, but I am with you. Yes. Okay, the third model, so I can end. We can end with this, is the possibility of not getting married at all. Can you get a note from your rabbi to not get married at all? That's the question, really. And the answer is maybe. So I put in some sources here. The Rachel Adler has suggested who's a great reform rabbi, suggested a Brit Ahuvim, an alternative ceremony that's designed not to be Kiddushin at all. It would be ultimately based in the halachic concept of concubine, okay, of pilegish, where you have, which doesn't sound good. We need a better word, right? But that's the halachic terminology. So this is, you could see why there's reticence about it. The kiddushin is a nice word. Pilegish is not a nice word. But you can see that if you did, and And there are those that will say, and there's a chapter here in this book too, that even if you are just a Pelagish, that perhaps you have also undergone, have had some sort of implicit marriage, because Eina Damose Bilatso Bilats Nut. By that, nobody really wants to have promiscuous sex, and so surely they got married. And so there's a presumption that they're married. And so some halachic authorities say, even if you didn't get married, even if you're a concubine, which the Rambam thinks is prohibited, and the Shulchan Aruch entertains also might be permitted. The Rama seems, the Rav Yosef Karo doesn't allow. The Rama seems to allow. And the... So it's halachically controversial, but let's say we went with it. Then there's this question of do you undergo some automatic marriage, common law marriage, basically? Does common law marriage now have some halachic status as well? And that has some amount of that has halachic controversy around it. In my opinion, most of the halachic authorities think that it's okay, that you're not automatically married. You, on purpose, went out of your way not to get halachically married. Mm-hmm. So when you go out of your way to not be halachically married, then you can say, you didn't get married because you made clear that you didn't want to get married. And besides, who says it is bilatznut, it's promiscuous sex? You are having a, the category, the klal, why we assume you would get married is because ein adam oseh bilatso bilatznut. A person doesn't want his sex to be promiscuous sex, and so therefore he surely did kiddushin, and she surely consented. And but perhaps this isn't bilatznut. Perhaps this is another monogamous relationship called pilegish. And that would be allowed. Okay, again, the Rambam seems to oppose it, but it's out there. Okay, so those are the options. You can see that two of the three work for our poor victim in Kiryat Shmona, but they're halachically controversial. In my mind, if women were were voting with their feet, and using these two things, the rabbis would have to decide. Either we're going to solve the problem from within, and then we can stick with it, then the prenup is enough, right? If the rabbis were solving the problems, then you wouldn't go to these extreme solutions. But so we go to the extreme solutions that puts pressure on the rabbis to take care of their house better. And so in this sense, I think that it might be that we just... women should be refusing to get married. I certainly feel like, yeah, I don't want my daughter to be at risk of these things.
The rabbi who married me in 1980 had actually said if he had been a Jewish woman, he would never get married. And he himself felt that an Orthodox rabbi, all Jewish women should, but that would never happen, should just say, no, we're not getting married until this is solved.
And then it will be solved. Then so I think that's solved. What, so I'm showing here some solutions that I think are... they're bold. I don't have the wide shoulders, but I think this is actually something that's going to have to come from below rather than from above. Meaning it's not going to be some great rabbi that's going to come up and say, it's going to be people who are refusing to get married and people who are finding ways to use this, what's called Heskei Mishulash, to use Susan Weiss's marriage or just avoiding the courts altogether and having common law marriage or doing some non-kiddushin kiddushin. And then once that becomes common, the rabbis will have to take action. Yes, I'm done.
Two questions. One is, what does one do with a civil marriage outside the country when they come into Israel? Cyprus has always been an option. It's just become
That's this option. That's option three, really.
Okay.
That's really option three.
Why place the burden on young people or people who are getting married? Where is that huge voice of rabbinic leadership that doesn't like this and keeps its mouth shut?
That's what I'm saying. I don't think it's going to come from the rabbis because it's their power and they're not going to...
The Haredi rabbis have the power. It's a fairly small subset of the Haredi rabbis. But there's a huge group of rabbis out there who are silently unhappy about this, and it's just Tzohar and a few others that are doing something about it.
Well, this not even that much. But I'm trying to, but so this is what I meant. That was the point of this class, was to show you what's holding them back. It's real fear. And they don't, and because the main job is do no wrong. They don't want to, God forbid, give you, they'd rather not have their hand in your sin, right? They don't want to play a part in giving you a bad get. And because of their fear of giving you a bad get, so they choose not to take any action. Once we have the situation that Dana was talking about, which is like, well, everyone is, now people are just sinning anyway, that actually is moving the rabbis very much. Because when they see the reality is, it's not like, oh, I'll just let the woman's life be ruined. It's actually that now people are just acting anyway. You didn't give them the divorce, and people are going on with their life and ignoring what the court said. And that moves them.
Ultimately, who determines that a get is not good and that the child would be a monster?
Right. Well, so the court key, the
perception,
state.
And so if the rabbis actually held with solidarity with each other and decided that they were not going to declare get
monster. If the state did not have power.
That. And so people, you know, so the people who said that this woman who's, you know, who got it through, because of the vegetative state, that, you know, that her children, if she remarries, and stuff like that. But if all the rabbis said, no, that's, we support it, and therefore it is legally binding, then they could.
Right.
So it is a failure. All
absolutely.
Rabbis.
So that's what we have to see. What will happen to this woman in Kiryat Shmona? Who's good at, right? Meaning, who's going to remarry her?
Right. So I mean, in truth, they're not really afraid of momzering. They're afraid of losing their own power and authority, and the fact that they can't actually agree with each other on anything and come together.
And ironically,
because they build their status by disagreeing with each other and casting each other against each other in all sorts of instances, and it's really little boys playing with their things. And if you ever watch a bunch of 9-year-old boys trying to make the rules for any sport, then that's all they do. They never actually get around to playing the sport because they're arguing over the rules all the time.
It's actually worse when their parents get involved. Yeah.
So I think that is the issue. Okay, I want thank you all very much for coming. I'm happy to keep talking to people, but I want to also slide release this.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.